All right, I am here with Alexander Mercuris in London, and I also have with me the great Robert Barnes. Mr. Barnes, where can people find you?
At vivabarneslaw.locals.com. That's where the, for any information and all curated content, that's where that's at.
All right, and I will put a link to all that information underneath this video in the description box down below. And thank you very much, Robert, for joining us. You had a busy month last month, that's for sure. And maybe even further back, you've been working very hard, and everyone knows that you've done some great work on the Rittenhouse case, the Rittenhouse commentary. You've appeared, I saw you on Laura Ingraham a couple weeks ago, fantastic there. And we were following everything you were doing with the Rittenhouse case. So since we have you with us, give us your thoughts, wrap it all up as to what went down with Rittenhouse.
Well, in my reason for getting involved with Kyle's case and representing him for about a year was because of the, and never billing him a penny or a nickel or a dime or dollar, was because of how significant his case was, but how emblematic he is of the American criminal justice system in both possible directions. So one was, if you could convict Kyle Rittenhouse in a place like Kenosha, Wisconsin, without recognizing self-defense rights, then nobody had self-defense rights that could be protected in the United States going forward, because that's a very middle America town, hodgepodge of immigrant communities in Kenosha. It was a place that barely voted for Trump twice, otherwise a longstanding Union Democratic area, was raided by outsiders in August of 2020, the Summer of Love, as the mayor of Seattle called it, where there were riots and looting and arson and beatings all across America. But Kenosha was not a town that was accustomed to that. It's not Seattle, it's not Portland, it's not Chicago, it's not New York, it's not any of those places. And so it was shocked and horrified to witness what happened. And here you have a 17-year-old kid step up to the plate, step into the gap. The gap that's not being served by the police, who have decided to abandon parts of Kenosha, not being served by the National Guard because the Democratic governor thinks the riots are good for Biden and bad for Trump, so he doesn't send in the National Guard to protect Kenosha. So Kenosha's a lot of ordinary people are basically have their dreams, see it literally, go up in smoke during night after night after night of rioting and looting and arson, including beatings that took place. And this was in the context of that same activity, that same criminal activity, dozens of deaths that took place, including an African-American police officer in St. Louis and other places that were just trying to protect their businesses, protect their property, protect themselves, and protect other people. And so into that gap steps a 17-year-old kid from a little bedroom community right across the border in Antioch, Illinois, which is Kenosha what Alexandria, Virginia is to Washington, D.C., basically a suburb of Kenosha. His father lived in Kenosha, aunt lived in Kenosha, grandmother lived in Kenosha, he worked in Kenosha, all of his best friends were in Kenosha, he was as Kenoshan could go. And he sees his community getting torched and destroyed, and dreams getting ruined, and people's lives getting taken upside down, and basically these riotous looters making a mockery of both law and order and justice within their middle America community. Kenosha, 1945, old documentary said, "Welcome to America's town." That's what they were witnessing, as America's town go up in flames. And so he, along with some friends of his, he was asked, "Would you help protect this? Would you help stop this from happening another night? And would you help treat people that are there?" Because he had the basic training as a, he wasn't a full EMT, but he had EMT caliber training as a lifeguard in Kenosha, trained lifeguard in Kenosha. He also had training in the use of weapons for defensive and other purposes through his police patrol training when he was a teenager, as well as his individual training with others, including his friend and his friend's stepfather previously. He agrees to go down there, and what he is he's there in particular defending businesses that are minority, immigrant, woman-owned businesses, because those were the targets primarily throughout Kenosha that night. It wasn't the white man, it wasn't the establishment, it wasn't the old Yankee aristocracy that still lived on the lake coast of lakeshore of Kenosha County that was being targeted. It was little immigrant-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses that were disproportionately being attacked. He and his friends decide to defend those businesses. They come under attack. A group of people tried to ambush him that night. All of the people that he ended up using force against in self-defense were people that all of them, every one of them, not only had long criminal records, but very dangerous criminal records involving family members, involving children. And so that's who he had to defend. They try to chase him down. They try to ambush him. They try to hit him over the head with a skateboard. They pulled a gun right on his head. They try to kick him in the head. They try to take his gun multiple times. In every case, he was defending himself. He'd never used force until the last possible moment. And then he used the most limited force he could under the circumstances. But he's a poor kid from a poor family. His father's, not married with his mom. They can only provide limited financial support. His mom was an 80-hour a week working double shift, as a nursing aide. And he had an older sister, a younger sister, both teenagers as well. And all of a sudden, their lives are turned upside down. They were receiving death threats the same night as the incident occurred. He turned himself in. They posted a crazy $2 million cash bail, which means he had to come up with $2 million cash to even not stay in jail pending trial. Luckily, people all across the country were so shocked and horrified by this brazen, overt attack on self-defense rights that they raised the money for him to fully post bail. And in fact, he did fully post bail. But during that interim, he's being defamed and libeled by the likes of the President of the United States, the New York institutional media, the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, daily running completely false and fake stories, accusing him of being a vigilante. There was nothing about what he did was being a vigilante, accused him of white supremacy. He has mixed race family members. The idea that there's no history of racism at all. They did a colonoscopic review of his social media and his phone, both of which were turned over fully and freely to the government. They found not one iota of a single racist comment, racist statement, racist suggestion, support of anything racist whatsoever. As he's publicly said, he was very sympathetic and supportive of the ideas that BLM was supporting, the idea of Black Lives Matter. He just didn't support violence and criminals and sociopaths using it as a guise to wage war on his hometown. It finds himself, usually poor families get crushed. Poor defendants usually get crushed. You had a corrupt prosecutor here who helped suborn perjury, tried to suborn perjury as a witness testified live at trial, obstructed justice, hid evidence, faked evidence, created one set of evidence for the defense and one set of evidence for the jury with critical video testimony and video documentary evidence. Evidence magically shows up in the middle of trial with no explanation as to its origination. And that doesn't even get into his impermissible efforts to talk about Kyle asserting his Fifth Amendment rights, his impermissible efforts to introduce evidence the court had said were patently prejudicial and impermissible and inadmissible in the trial. Tried to do it live right in front of the jury, misstated the law repeatedly, both in opening and closing statements, flat out lied about the facts repeatedly in both opening statements and closing arguments. But despite that aggregate effort of governmental corruption, the honest, good people of Middle America, Kenosha, stepped up to the plate, found him not guilty and acquitted him of all charges because he was always not guilty. He was most innocent defendant I've ever represented, one of the sweetest kids and one of the sweetest families I've ever had the privilege to defend. And he was always innocent all along. The jury recognized it, and every governmental trick and media trick failed to work. But of course, the media's reaction was to pretend it was something else, and half of them are still lying about the kid to this very day.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that masterly summary, Robert. Can I just first of all begin by saying that I and Alex, we not only followed you through the trial, we followed you long before. The strategy that you outlined whilst you were acting for Kyle is the strategy that prevailed at the trial. I think congratulations are in order. I mean, I'm not taking away credit from other people. I'm just saying that congratulations to you are in order. And unequivocally, the good result, the correct result was delivered in this case. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is that had this decision gone the other way, I think this is exactly the point which you made about self-defense. Because I have to say, the more I read about this, the more I heard about this case, and not just from yourself, the more straightforward a self-defense case than this, it would be very difficult to imagine. You spoke about Kyle being innocent. He is innocent. Now, I've been to many cases. I've followed many cases. There are many cases where you find people are not guilty. But not guilty doesn't necessarily mean they are actually innocent. This is one of those rare cases where somebody is positively, undoubtedly, indisputably innocent. It is extraordinary. It is incredibly disturbing that this prosecution was ever brought at all. And it was brought in exactly the way you said, by with tricks being played by the prosecution, which I just could never have imagined would be played out in a courtroom. And I'm going to say something else. Now, I may be wrong about this. This may be my own interpretation. But one factor that did work in Kyle's favour is that he had a very old-fashioned, rather conservative judge who just believed that due process should apply and the law should be acted upon, administered impartially. I mean, if we'd had a much more political judge, well, it might not have been like that. But as I said, this is a rather, he's come in for a lot of criticism, but I would say he did exactly the right thing, and good for him too. So the jury carried out the right verdict. A totally innocent young man coming from a family which used to be the bedrock of the Democratic Party, the sort of people that the Democratic Party in the days of FDR and JFK and LBJ, they were there, they always used to say that they were there to look after, support, represent those sort of people. And look how they've turned on them now.
Does anything about America, Robert, the verdict? I mean, I'm kind of curious, does this change the trajectory, the vibe in the United States, or do you think this is kind of like a one-off?
I think it was a key defense, is the way I put it. Like, in other words, if we lost this case, then self-defense was in great danger, because you couldn't have a more innocent client than Kyle Rittenhouse. You couldn't have a better set of self-defense facts than Kyle's case. And you couldn't have a fairer, more impartial, more truly American jury pool than Kenosha. And you had all the corruption of the press, which lied about Kyle for months and months leading up to the trial, lied throughout the trial. I mean, when a key witness admitted that Kyle didn't shoot him at all until he pulled up and lifted his gun to point right at his face, the headline from the media was, they buried that story. You had to go to like paragraph 17 to find that story. Instead, the headline that my other liberal friends were reading was, he was so thankful, but he thought he was going to die. That was his headline. And this was a guy who, by the way, had committed DUI and other crimes that they cleaned up his record just days before he took the stand, had a history of criminal violence, didn't lawfully have that gun that night, was not charged with any of it, and was clearly out to commit violence, and was part of a communist insurrectionary group. Which in America, the idea of radical violent leftist is still a very new phenomenon since at least the 1960s, late 1960s, early 70s. But everybody in America kind of saw that as a one-off. We didn't have a lot of radical communist violence in the 20s or 30s in the States like happened in Europe. And we had some in the late 60s, early 70s, but it was seen as so weird and so different and so odd that it was seen as just not part of the American DNA, and then went away, and we didn't have it in the 80s. And even in the 90s, you know, I mean, the Black Bloc Antifa tactics started in Germany in the mid 70s and early 80s with the May Day protests, where they decide, hey, it's May Day, so let's go commit some violence. That routine, that didn't show up until the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle in 1999. And at that point, it was still seen as foreigners coming in. It wasn't seen as Americans. It wasn't until Antifa's modern rise, 2014, 15, 16, starting in Portland. And even then we thought, well, that's just crazy Portland. Not part of it. Until the summer of 2020, America had never seen anything quite like this. They'd seen occasional race-driven protest in big cities, late 60s, early 90s, but that was seen as limited to those issues. Not radical leftists, because that's who raided Kenosha. It wasn't North Milwaukee Black civil rights protesters and others who decided to go down to Kenosha. It was almost all the people causing all the violence were criminal sociopaths, and almost all of them were white. But what they had in common is, like, this one witness was a affiliate, a proud affiliate of a communist insurrectionary group. And in Europe, that would be quickly identified for what it is, given the history. But in the States, it's still like, what? You know, it's still foreign. So that's why this verdict had so much impact, so much significance, so much consequence. It was about the right of self-defense. It was whether a poor kid could get a fair trial. And it was also about whether the left could take over the streets, and anybody who exercised the violent left and anybody who exercised defense against them was going to be targeted themselves for criminal prosecution and criminal punishment. And so it's like it's the political weaponization of the prosecutorial process, which we've witnessed throughout the Biden administration, which frankly we witnessed against Trump by Trump's own FBI and Justice Department while Trump was there. So it's the same pattern of behavior. But this was, if Kyle went down, America went down. And that's why it was critical that Kyle win, because it preserved core fundamental self-defense liberties, which is what I think the Second Amendment is all about. And if you don't have that Second Amendment self-defense right, you really don't have any of the other rights, because they're all dependent on it ultimately for self-enforcement.
I absolutely agree. Can I just say, I mean, if this case had gone the other way, I mean, the implications would have been terrible. I mean, it would have been a terrifying case, a terrifying outcome. It would have meant essentially that you're in danger of losing control of the streets. Now, I remember, I'm just old enough to remember that earlier period of left-wing violence in the late 60s and early 70s. And it is completely different from today. Today, it is immeasurably more organized. It's organized on state, cross state level across the United States in a way that just wasn't the case then. It's like comparing Bonnie and Clyde with the mob, if I can put it like that. It's a completely different type of thing. And the fact that it is getting help from agencies of the government all across the United States, both at state level and even more at federal level, means that this is an extraordinarily dangerous moment for the United States, for America. And if a situation had arisen where in a town like Kenosha you just couldn't get that kind of protection, well, frankly, as I said, no place in America would have been safe. So I think it is an important case. To what extent it resonates, I'm not going to say. I'm not going to try and guess. But what I will say is this. Lose that and you lose everywhere. Win that and you have a chance. And that is a fundamental point, I think. Now, just to say about the coverage of by the media, I have to say it's one of the most profoundly shocking things I've ever seen. Now, we have perhaps a different culture to some extent here in Britain, but more prejudicial coverage on the eve of a case, I cannot remember. It is in Britain, some of this would be considered, frankly, contemptuous. This has been peeling away a lot in Britain in the last decade or so. But I still was profoundly shocked by it. And what makes it far worse is that this same prejudicial coverage is continuing even after a comprehensive acquittal. And again, given how important the media is, given the fact that the media in the United States has a semi-institutional role as part of the American, I won't say constitutional, but a part of the American political system, that was how it evolved. That's an extraordinarily disturbing thing, and it is as disturbing in its own way as the fact that the prosecutorial system has become combined with this organized, violent criminal activity that has been taking place in so many American towns and cities right across America. As I said, an important, a vitally important case. Its importance should not be underestimated.
Yeah, they're saying the meat. Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
I'll say, yeah, no doubt about it. I think it's one of the most important cases actually in American history. Definitely the most important one in the last decade. Because of all of its ramifications, which were so broad and ultimately global in impact. But it is unsettling. It's like watching a live version of, you know, Babylon Berlin, the German TV show about the rise of the Nazis and their involvement in co-conspiracies between the militia street violence that was taking place and the police and military officers. Here we just have it on the left between Antifa and, you know, even a prosecutor in Kenosha willing to do the bidding of a corrupt press and corrupt politicians to try to corrupt the criminal justice process. That's what's terrifying. It's like, this is not just New York and a couple of lawyers throwing Molotov cocktails at cop cars and getting these sweetheart deals, or, you know, Antifa folks taking axes and getting off in D.C. or Portland. This was in Kenosha, which meant we had a whole different animal. And it was a critical defense that he win. But the mere fact it even occurred is very says something very precarious about law in the day and age of American politics today.
Yeah, they're saying like this red pilled a lot of people in the United States to the media lies and the media manipulation. And I agree with that. I just wonder how much of an effect it had, especially given now that, you know, the media is driving so much of the narrative, for example, with vaccines, with mandates, with QR codes, certificates, scanning. I wonder if this is going to carry over, this red pilling as to what happened with Kyle and the media manipulation there, if this is going to carry over to, one might say, even more important issues that we're facing right now, which is the vaccines and the QR codes, certificates, digital IDs, all of that stuff. I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is going to carry over and have an effect there?
I think potentially. I mean, the counterpoints to it would be, you know, what happened in the Chauvin trial. There's a good number of people that, while they thought Chauvin was guilty of something, didn't think that was the most fair trial. Where now Kim Potter is the taser cop. She's being tried. People who know her vouch for her, say that, you know, and that really she was trying to exercise self-defense in that instance. But can the Twin Cities provide a fair and impartial jury? The Arbery case down in Georgia, where people took sort of law enforcement into their own hands, which I and some others thought legally they were entitled to do under Georgia law, what everyone thought of Georgia law. But the quickness with which both the judge and the jury wanted a conviction and got a conviction. Those are sort of the counterpoints to the narrative. And then you won't see any cameras in the Ghislaine Maxwell trial because, by golly, because this was educational to a large number of people. Like, people were introduced to my buddy, my friend Nick Riccata, who live streamed the whole Rittenhouse case. He more than doubled his subscribers. People were introduced to what is good legal analysis outside of the CBS Newses of the world, outside of the Dan Abrams of the world. You know, introduced Andrew Branca, Law of Self-Defense, a range of people that provide independent commentary the way you guys do on international news across the globe. And when people, like I used to tell people that hated Alex Jones, like if you hate Alex Jones, then start doing truthful media coverage. Because the number one thing that boosts Alex Jones is people lying in the institutional media. It's not that people go to Jones and think now the institutional media is bad. They recognize and discover for themselves the institutional media is bad and then seek out Alex Jones. And so what is good about all of this is the media lied so profusely, so profligately about the Rittenhouse trial. And they said that he killed minority people. Totally false. In fact, one of the people he defended himself against that night was using racial epithets all night long and was racial cursing black people and other people all night long in the language he was using. And again, it was Kyle defending minority women, immigrant-owned businesses from these predatorial white sociopathic criminals who were engaged in racist language all night long. So it shocked a lot of people, even on the left. And then you saw people like Glenn Greenwald and Jimmy Dore. Even the Young Turks had to issue a kind of an apology. You know, it's as much of an apology as the Young Turks can do. But because they were so shocked that they thought Kyle was the one chasing, not the one being chased all night long. That Kyle was the one knocking people on the ground, not the one being knocked on the ground all night long. That Kyle was the aggressor, not the defender. When in fact, that was all of their myths were false. That he crossed state lines with a gun, totally false. That his mom drove him there and dropped him off to commit vigilante violence. False, false, false. All these stories were false, which even just a little bit of research they would have known. But I think it did red pill a lot of people about the media, particularly about coverage of trials. But it's why our federal court system ain't going to let no cameras into trials like Ghislaine Maxwell, because they don't want the world to see how our criminal system works for themselves. They don't want independent legal commentary that's not controlled by the institutional narrative to be heard by the ordinary person. And that's what if Rittenhouse hadn't been video described, people don't go to Nick Riccata's channel to get it. And then they don't discover you can get independent legal commentary that's not what the CBS people were saying, which was misdefining the self-defense law on the eve of jury deliberations. The national CBS legal correspondents completely got wrong basic self-defense principles. So I think it was a red pill moment, but it shows how far we've come and also how far we still need to go, that the federal courts can shut out cameras from a trial as publicly important and consequential as the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, which has now started in the Southern District of New York.
Absolutely. And can I just say, on the question of media coverage, bear in mind that because in Britain we are more further away from the events at Kenosha, people haven't watched the video of the actual trial. So, of course, the media narrative about the trial, the media constructed narrative about the trial in Britain is still almost entirely unchallenged. So you will still find a newspaper like The Independent, which is a mainstream newspaper, writing something like the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed three black people, for example. And they do that after the jury has delivered its verdict, after the trial is over, and they do so without anybody basically coming back and responding and pointing out that that is wrong. So it's within the United States and within people like us who are, you know, based in Europe, Alex and I, but we take an interest in the events of the United States. Obviously, there has been a degree of people being red-pilled. But in the broader world, I'm afraid, to a great extent, to a dangerous extent, this false media narrative is still accepted and is still widely believed and will remain so. And, of course, it also feeds in to many fantasies, and I really do believe that they're fantasies, that people have about America. This belief, for example, we're not going to go into this now, but, you know, that there's this vast right-wing militia movement in the United States, which I have repeatedly told people, I mean, I consider it to be a complete utopian, nonsensical fantasy. I don't think there's anything like that in the United States. But in Europe, lots of people believe it. So, I mean, it's something that I'm afraid, in Britain at least, it's not been corrected. And most people will tell you, taking their cue from an, I thought, even more outrageous comment by the President of the United States directly after the decision. He said that he was angry because the jury gave a verdict, implying, as far as I could see, that he thought the verdict was wrong, which is, I mean, I think was an outrageous thing to say. But I think that is, people would know about that. They take their cue from what the President of the United States said. And very bad that is, and very, very troubling for the United States.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, and it's what I tell people is you can find all these right-wing racist militia members the same place you can find all of Putin's spies who stole the 2016 election in the United States. They're in the same invisible location because they don't exist.
Exactly.
But it's part of the same mantra. And you're right, the media narrative's ability to control things is reflective of what's happening in the Ghislaine Maxwell case. Because here you have a case, you know, there's, you know, her father, famous British publisher, was on, I mean, who knows how many spy payrolls from Moscow to Tel Aviv to London, and maybe to Langley too, who died under, you know, interesting circumstances. Not everybody falls off a boat at a key critical convenient juncture. But here you have his daughter on trial in the United States for and the question I had was, how are they going to cabin the narrative? How are they going to control this story so it doesn't touch the Clintons, so it doesn't necessarily get into Prince Andrew and the royal family, so it doesn't touch Langley, so it doesn't touch Tel Aviv, so it doesn't touch Moscow, it doesn't touch any place wherever Epstein and Maxwell and her father may have had ties and connections? Because there was a narrative here that all the way back that Epstein didn't introduce Ghislaine Maxwell to that world of honey traps and blackmail and extortion and underage sex trafficking. Rather, she may have been the one to introduce him to it by inheriting part of the machine that her father had after his death. But what's fascinating is right in the middle of all this, one, they're going to not allow any video broadcasting because the federal court's still not doing that in the States, which I think is embarrassing. You have a constitutional right to public trials here in America. And to me, that means in the modern age, using every digital means and mechanism by which if you could see the trial live inside the courthouse, if we have the technological means, that should be broadcast to the world. That's what public access should mean in the modern age. It used to mean we used to have trials outdoors. The whole community would come and watch. So I think that's always been unconstitutional. But guess who gets to decide whether it's unconstitutional? The same courts that institute the rule in the first place. It's one of the flaws, that, unfortunately, in our the way in which the courts have applied the Constitution here in America. But The other key factor is they've controlled the prosecution. James Comey's daughter magically shows up in the middle of this prosecution. It's like, how does that happen? Southern District of New York, one of the most infamously corrupt prosecutorial units, in my view, in the last 30 years. You look at what they're doing and going after Project Veritas while leaking information that they illicitly seized from Project Veritas and James O'Keefe to the New York Times, who Project Veritas is suing for libeling them and trying to run them out of business. I mean, just the Steve Bannon cases, the Save the Wall cases, all the craziness from the Southern District of New York, which managed to never investigate the Clinton Foundation. Apparently, Clinton Foundation was the cleanest international foundation in the history of politics and man, according to the Southern District of New York. But Project Veritas is scary, 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 and needs 6 a.m. raids to do things. This is who's handling the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. And my view is that they wanted to cabin this case, that they were going to try to cabin it. Well, first, they were able to cabin it in terms of not having live video broadcasting for people to make their own determinations about what's happening at the trial and to limit Maxwell's ability to just get information and intel out that she might want to as a device to save herself. She doesn't have easy broadcasting rights. Nobody except who's in the courtroom can see and hear what's taking place fully. Then secondly, they corrupt the prosecution by having the Southern District of New York bring this. This case could have been brought many cases across the country. Why did it need to be the Southern District of New York? And then they have James Comey, one of the most corrupt FBI directors in American history. Somehow, magically, his daughter ends up in the middle of the case. And then last but not least, they had to recreate the Pentagon Papers case, the Daniel Ellsberg case. For people who don't remember, I mean, that was one of the most, before Julian Assange, the other craziest prosecution of a whistleblower in American history was Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers. I mean, they were, before they stopped by the Watergate for a little midnight raid, those same plumbers who had long spooky histories before they showed up on that list of working for Nixon, a lot of three-letter agency work, you know, guys like Frank Sturgis, who magically ends up in the hills outside of in the Sierra Madre with Fidel, and then somehow ends up as one of the burglars in Watergate, and who's one of the plumbers to, you know, I mean, how does that happen? But they spied on him, his shrink records, all the rest. But people forget in Ellsberg's case, one of the things that blew it up was the Nixon administration was trying to corrupt the judge presiding over the proceedings by having back channel conversations, offering him to be director of FBI or anything else he wanted if he just made sure Ellsberg was convicted. And what do we have in the middle of the Maxwell trial? In the middle of the Maxwell trial, all of a sudden the Biden administration gets the inspired idea, as well as the dear Senate majority, Senate majority co-leader, Schumer from New York, decide to nominate this judge who's presiding over the Maxwell trial to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. But that is only going to go through after the trial. The nomination is first. Confirmation comes after the court makes sure this trial stays a certain way. And my view is what they're trying to do is cabin the facts, limit the facts, to make sure it doesn't touch anybody politically connected to any of the spy agencies she clearly has connections to. Reminds me a lot of the Noriega case, where they went to great lengths to cabin the Noriega case so it didn't go into certain places like the Bush family and him being on the payroll since the 1970s of the U.S., etc. And the prosecutor who handled that so well, of course, was one Robert S. Mueller. So I think we're seeing some history repeat itself in the Maxwell trial in New York.
What do they want to do to Maxwell, Alexander, though? What do you think Ghislaine herself?
Lock her away so she can't talk, I suppose. I mean, that's probably what they want to do. But, I mean, coming back to the point that Robert was making, I mean, first of all, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think all the facts point to an incredibly controlled trial. You're trying to control as much as possible what he said, what the defense is going to be allowed to say, what the prosecution is going to say. Everything is going to be restricted to a very small, discreet element of activities that were taking place. You're not going to have anything like the kind of searchlight that you really need in order to find out exactly what was going on and to get to the bottom of this affair. And of course, Ghislaine herself has been giving interviews, by the way, to the British media and has been trying to recruit sympathy here, I don't think with very much success. It is very widely believed here in Britain what you said, Robert, that it was actually she who introduced Epstein to all sorts of people rather than the other way around. Remember, we know Maxwell. We know the father. We remember Robert Maxwell extremely well here. I mean, I used to know people who worked for him, by the way, so I know exactly the kind of person he was. So I think that is absolutely right. Now, once they used to say, you know, is that there was that famous tag that, you know, justice mustn't only be done, it must be seen to be done, because that is necessary in order to establish trust in the legal system. A trial conducted in this fashion, in essential secrecy, with this extraordinary degree of control, coming after all the doubts and worries that people already have about the Epstein case. Well, all I could say is it's not going to strengthen people's trust in the system. It's going to undermine it even further. And there will be a stronger conviction even than there was already, which is already pretty strong, that the legal justice system in the United States, or at least parts of it, protect some people even as they come after others. So, you know, coming back to Carl Rittenhouse, they go after Carl Rittenhouse, but they won't really go into the real stories of what went on in the Ghislaine Maxwell case, even, and the Maxwell case and the Epstein case and all those things, because far too many important people are involved. And to that list of countries that you gave, Robert, I would add Saudi Arabia, because one of the weirdest things I understand is that Epstein had a Saudi passport. Heavens knows what that was all about. Mm-hmm.
Hanging out with MBS.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. So you think they're just going to just, their goal is to get Ghislaine and just hide her away somewhere, just dispose of her, just close the book on all of this.
Yes, I think so. I mean, to be honest, I can't see her being acquitted. I mean, I would be astonished if she was. I mean, I know that I shouldn't say that, but that's what I think, to be straightforward about this. And I think if she was acquitted, I think there'd be an uproar. I think so. I don't think they want that to happen. So I think they want it locked away somewhere, out of sight, out of mind. We, you know, turn the page on the whole affair and things in all other respects go on exactly as always. I think that's pretty much the agenda here. And as I said, it's already deepened the cynicism that you see in so many places, among so many people in the United States. I mean, I mean, without wanting to go too far, I mean, I'm even getting people joking to me, and I'm not talking about Americans, I'm talking about British people, about, you know, if something happens to me, I might be Epstein'd. I mean, that kind of, it's becoming a catchphrase. Well, I mean, even in Britain.
I think what the system would like is for Ghislaine Maxwell to be under the delusion that she could win at trial or win on appeal so that she doesn't talk about certain subjects or certain issues, and thus keep her cabin. The court's there to keep things in check. If either court wants to get up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, make sure the defense isn't allowed to broach any places they're not supposed to, or any witness go to places they're not supposed to. Prosecution's already protected because it's Southern District of New York, and you have the Comey girl there, Comey's daughter. But I think ultimately where this ends, like 3 years out, she's convicted, her appeal's exhausted, and to make sure she doesn't talk, she gets Whitey Bulger'd. Because people forget, before you got Epstein'd, there was Whitey Bulger, who they waited for to let him have the illusion that maybe he could get back out. Then they just kind of sent him to a jail where he was, where people, they knew people would kill him, just kind of accidental. And all of a sudden, he's dead within a month or two of being there. So whatever other secrets Whitey had went with him to that prison grave. It wouldn't surprise me to see her get a similar outcome once she no longer has hope. Because I think right now she has hope that either the trial or the appeal will go her way. And I think once, because she thinks the appeal, because the plea bargain, she has actually a decent legal argument. I mean, they did cut a very broad plea deal that it did appear to inoculate her for anything. But so she's got an unusually robust legal appeal. I just think no court's going to come to the protection of Ghislaine Maxwell. It's like the Arbery trial in that sense. The McMichaels and defendants may have a robust appeal about the judge's failure to properly instruct on citizens' arrest law in Georgia. It's just, is any court going to come to the rescue of people that have been politically demonized in the court of public opinion? It's very hard. So, I mean, I think she's trying to do the right thing at trying to influence court of public opinion, but she's gone. I mean, what she really needed to do was play the card that maybe Epstein tried to play and was, you know, got Epstein'd by the time. And that's her other problem. How does she play the Epstein card of, let me tell you about what I was really doing for the last 20 years, like Noriega tried to do, and say, hey, I've been on U.S. payroll. I thought everything I did was U.S. government approved for the last 30 years. I got to be president thanks to the U.S. government. Now you're arresting me? But all that evidence they kept out, the court was complicit with Mueller to suppress it, so the world never heard much about it, other than his defense lawyer claiming something existed that he was never allowed to testify to. I think it's the same goal with her, and she's trying to. I don't know if I was her exact. I would have some kill switches like McAfee purported to have, but clearly didn't ultimately have. And you know, but I don't think she necessarily does, or at least they don't think she does. Is my guess. They wouldn't have kept her locked up this long.
Oh, I would add that I think she's out of her depth. Actually, I think that I don't get the impression that. To be straightforward about it, she's getting the kind of advice, perhaps, that she should be getting and the kind of legal support that she should be getting. I mean, that might be unfair, but I reading some of her
if the system is doing their
if
the system is doing their job, they would make sure that's the case. Well, they would convince her that certain lawyers are the best lawyers. She goes to those lawyers. Those lawyers actually play ball at keeping the case cabined. I mean, I call it captured counsel. Criminal defendants do it all the time. Like, let's say you're a big drug dealer. You make sure you handpick all your lawyers for all of your other co-defendants, because that way you're controlling what they say. And if somebody's spilling the beans, you're going to find out, because the lawyer's going to spill it, or all of a sudden the lawyer says, oh, I can't do a joint defense agreement. You're like, okay, Georgie's ratting. But it wouldn't surprise me if the system coordinate. When it's smart, the system makes sure they control the lawyer for the defendant, because they got to make sure things stay on script. Because I've been curious at how nothing has come out that could put her in a different light or politically expose powerful people. I mean, for those who don't remember, I mean, Epstein himself was hired by Bill Barr's father at the gay, got him his first gig. And Bill Barr's father, let's just had some very interesting novelistic interest. Let's put it that way. It might have corresponded to Epstein's particular unique behavior. But yeah, I think they're going to get away with it. Like right now, it looks like the real broader story of Maxwell is not going to be told in this criminal trial, thanks in large part to the actions of a lot of political actors.
Absolutely. Can I just finish on this by saying that, of course, in Britain, we have a particular interest in the case because of the way in which it touches on Prince Andrew and on the activities of the royal family. And again, the British authorities, I am absolutely sure, who are very embarrassed about this, will be talking quietly to the people at the Southern District of New York or the Justice Department, and they will be saying, you know, please be very careful. This could turn out very badly for us, and you know, beware of what, you know, our concerns too. And you know, I think that kind of whispering in the ear is not without effect, actually.
But how did they let it get this far? Like, how did Epstein slip through the cracks for them? How did the system let Epstein, you know, get out of the system and get caught? Why did they arrest Ghislaine? How come they just didn't deal with her in some other way? I mean, how did they let it get to this point?
I think we'll see what Robert says, but I think firstly the enormity of this thing. I mean, it was just getting completely out of control. There were just too many people involved. There were too many victims. It was just becoming extremely difficult to keep this thing under suppressed. Bear in mind that it turns out that he was, you know, heavily doing all the things he'd always been doing, even after he'd been convicted. So, I mean, you know, it wasn't as if this had all stopped. So I think they were struggling to keep control of this, and people were coming forward and things of this kind. As for why she thought that she could, you know, stay in the United States and be arrested in that way. Well, I think that's a real mystery. I don't really have a simple answer to that. But I come back to what I said. I think she was out of her depth. And it may be that she relied on, I won't say promises, but, you know, had expectations that, of course, were not going to be fulfilled. In other words, that she was led to think that if she stayed where she was, nothing would happen to her. And that was a way of basically getting control of her and putting her through this very controlled legal process. So if it's as controlled as it looks, and as Robert says, which I'm sure he's right, by the way, then it doesn't really surprise me. And realistically, where would anywhere Ghislaine Maxwell go? I mean, where in the world would she escape to?
And I think it reveals two possible backstories that I see. One is that both of them were extraordinarily arrogant and had grown so accustomed to never being held accountable or responsible, kind of like her dad. Her dad grew crazy arrogant towards the end and assumed that he wasn't going to suffer consequences from stealing from pension funds and things like this. That probably could explain most of it. But in terms of their motivation to go after him, there was the second component of this is the victims' rights laws in the United States are really strong, and their failure to comply with those laws during the first plea deal, and then Epstein and Maxwell's choice to lie rather than write checks during civil suits probably put them on this path, because those were the people hammering in the court of public opinion for something to happen. The other component you can't rule out is that they antagonized the wrong people somewhere, someplace, at some time. That was always the story with her dad, that her dad made some ill-advised threats, and that's why he took an unintended dive into the ocean off his boat. And he got Epsteined before Epstein got Epsteined. And it may be the case that she and Epstein did the same thing, and that they did not have the really sophisticated backup plan that a true criminal mastermind would, because their ego, their arrogance probably exceeded their competence. And I think that's why the system wants to make sacrificial lambs of them to say, see, we're controlling this. There was never this crazy, we're not part of anything. They're justifying themselves to the victims who've raised such a stink about it, while at the same time making sure the whole world doesn't know what can happen. And I think that has a part of it. And if they get away with this, they'll have controlled this case. McAfee managed to die in custody. Epstein manages to die in custody. It's kind of like those crazy European cases where people started showing up connected to the CIA's effort to plant people left behind after World War II against the communists. And then they end up doing terrorism in places like at grocery stores in places like Holland and other places. And then all of a sudden key witnesses just disappear. There's aspects of that happening here. And I think the key they had is Ghislaine Maxwell's arrogance. And her naivete is a good way. She comes across as a spoiled kid who felt entitled to the world and can't understand consequence, still doesn't, and they're using that against her. And they're able to corrupt the process enough so that there's no loose elements that get too loose.
Absolutely. Since I'm somewhat pushed, can we deal with the mandates cases? Because this, of course, flows directly from some of our conversations that we had before. And it seems to me that things are beginning to come together in at least in the Court of Appeals of the Fifth Circuit, that some of the things that we were saying are now starting to come right. Now, I say that with some degree of uncertainty and unease, but Robert, perhaps you can give us your thoughts.
Sure. So I think the big mistake the Biden administration made was mandating the vaccine at a federal level, trying to use OSHA to mandate it, trying to use Center for Medicare Services to mandate it on medical institutions, mandating it on federal contractors and mandating it on federal employees. Had Biden stayed away from that, the courts were split, and half the courts were going with the old eugenics cases, the Jacobson case, which was the foundation for eugenics in the United States. It was the only case cited in the Buck case that greenlit forced sterilizations, that the Nazis cited repeatedly as their favorite case, as the legal basis and moral authority for their eugenics experimentation and other medical experimentation that the Nuremberg Code is supposed to put an end to. But the judges are still behind the ball. And like 80% of the country opposes vaccine mandates. As this has been rolled out, more and more people oppose the mandates, not fewer. But the judges are the last ones on board. And they were splitting. Half of them were saying your rights to religious accommodation, your rights to medical accommodation, your rights against discrimination based on disability meant that your employer, your government could, or your school could not force this particular vaccine on you. But half of them were saying, no, the Jacobson decision means you can inject whatever you want into a person anytime you want, regardless of medical reasons, regardless of religious objections, regardless of any other disability discrimination claims or public policy restrictions you may try to cite. But once even the U.S. Supreme Court played Pontius Pilate, both Kavanaugh and Barrett refused to get involved when Maine didn't allow nurses to even assert a religious accommodation right. Now Massachusetts' case up before the U.S. Supreme Court, New York has now followed. So you have those cases going one direction, while you have cases out of Florida and Tennessee and Texas and Missouri and Illinois and throughout the West, and even now in the Ninth Circuit going the opposite direction, saying, no, there has to be religious accommodations. And in America, religious accommodations just means your conscience. It doesn't require it be a specific religious belief. Atheists have the right to a religious objection under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So I brought suit against Tyson Foods. A lot of these big corporations are now claiming they're doing what they're doing as an agent of the government. So we've expanded our lawsuit against Tyson Foods to include the fact that they are an agent of the government, which now means they're governed by the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, which is even better than the First Amendment and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, adding First Amendment claims, Fourth Amendment claims, your right to bodily autonomy, right is part of medical privacy, which is part of the Fourth Amendment, right to due process under the Fifth Amendment, right to a certain degree in certain contexts for certain people under the Eighth Amendment. If you're a prisoner and you're being forced to take the vaccine, there's issues as to whether that's cruel and unusual punishment. Issues if you're a pretrial detainee, where they're trying to force that on the January 6 people to force them to take the vaccine. My view, that's an unreasonable condition of bail in violation of the Eighth Amendment. So you have different claims brought for different people, but we've united them against Tyson Foods where applicable. The two big cases is because as soon as the Biden administration started using OSHA to mandate this, use Medicare to mandate this, use federal contractor contracts to mandate this, my view was it was going to shift the politics, the zeitgeist within the professional class on the right, that all of a sudden state attorney generals, governors, big politicians, judges on the we're going to be like, whoa, hold on a second. And all of a sudden, judges that a lot of even people, judges on the right, happy with eugenics and other principles in principle, if you look at them historically by heritage, there's a lot of conservative judges that approved forced vaccines and approved forced sterilization and approved forced detention camps because they were the same ones that said you could own child labor in the early 1900s and that racial segregation was a great, great idea. You have all these liberals citing a court that said racial segregation was great. It's mind-boggling to watch. But the pushback started with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals on the OSHA mandate. They said this doesn't get anywhere near meeting the law. And in the process of doing so, they went beyond what they had to say. They could just focus on that OSHA did not meet the legal standards for issuing an emergency rule governing the workplace. They went further and pointed out that the mandate doesn't make sense on its face, given the limits of vaccine efficacy and given the limits of how dangerous the disease is to young, healthy adults. Now a federal court in Missouri did the same thing as to the Biden mandate in through the Center for Medicare, using Medicare to impose it on all healthcare institutions. They went further and said the vaccine mandate makes no sense, period, because one, you could test as an alternative, and two, it's not clear the vaccine is reducing the spread of COVID at all. It might reduce hospitalizations. It might reduce death, but there's no evidence it's reducing spread whatsoever. Indeed, we had worse COVID outbreaks in the countries that are the most vaccinated and in the regions of the countries that are the most vaccinated. So we're seeing it once that breakthrough happens, I think the courts are going to start to switch back.
Yeah,
I think the Supreme Court's going to say religious accommodations have to be protected and use that as a huge carve out for any mandate. But I think that the logic of Bill Gates's goal of being able to mandate vaccines and drugs, because this is really a drug, they just relabeled a vaccine. I'm about to bring suit against the FDA for Children's Health Defense with Bobby Kennedy, who's got a great book out about Anthony Fauci, by the way, and the whole history of this. And part of our argument is going to be the FDA can't just redefine the word vaccine to mean whatever it wants. Vaccine has had a specific definition for 100 years. They suddenly changed it just to meet the definition of these drugs because these drugs don't meet the traditional definition of vaccine because they don't sterilize. They don't inoculate. And the evidence of that is accumulating everywhere. Indeed, vaccinating may actually increase transmission risk because people who are vaccinated think they can't transmit. So they don't take other safety protocols and procedures, even when they have symptoms, because a bunch of people still think Joe Biden was telling the truth when he said you can't get the virus once you get vaccinated. So I think that's where we are.
Absolutely. Can I just say, I think that if you've managed to get, which you have managed to get, you've managed to get a corporate defendant to admit that they were acting as an agent for the federal government. I think that's a breakthrough, actually, in this. I really do. I mean, I think that has enormous implications for all of this litigation that we're seeing going forward. And I think that's something, again, which you deserve a second round of congratulations, Robert, if I could say that. The second is, I mean, coming back to some of the earlier things we said, I mean, what they are doing, where they have gone wrong is that they have tried to do something which they really don't have the legal authority to do. So they're scrabbling around trying to cobble something together, and they're coming up with these very complicated misuses of things like Medicaid and whatever. And it's unraveling before their eyes. It's unraveling for legal reasons, for very good legal reasons. It's unraveling for scientific reasons too. But of course, it's also unraveling for political reasons, exactly as you said. So it's a classic example of somebody who's getting very nervous in some ways about what they're doing. They're worried about the fact that, you know, what they're doing isn't very legally strong. It isn't very legally founded. Maybe they would have been better off relying on the old eugenics cases. But then, of course, if you're nervous, if you're worried, you always look to double down. You always look to sort of try and secure your position. So you go a step further. And of course, all you're doing it that way is you're creating a whole new set of problems for yourself. And I suspect that's what's happened. It's a classic example of what happens when you don't actually follow the spirit of the law, the flow of the law. If you're swimming against it, if you have real claimants against you, if you have decent lawyers, I was talking about you, Robert, against you, then it starts all, I could just see how it's all going to start getting increasingly unstuck. And as I said, congratulations again. I think that's a major breakthrough, actually. I mean, I think that's something that's going to start, you can see how it's going to sort of work all the way through. And with the fact that corporations are now saying that they were acting as agents of the federal government, it shows, first of all, that they sense that they're in a very, very precarious legal position. I mean, why else would they do a thing like that? So they're passing the buck to the federal government, and the federal government now finds that what it tried to do isn't really legally founded, and it's unraveling before their eyes. I mean, that's how it looks to me. So congratulations again.
Yeah, it's going the right direction, which is great to see. Yeah. And especially when it started out, the history, as I told people, was that the states have usually won in this. You know, all their forced vaccinations, forced sterilizations, forced detention camps, whenever they were litigated during a time of emergency, the courts ended up siding with the government and siding with the private corporations. And so thankfully the Biden administration so overreached so continuously and so arrogated to itself power it clearly didn't have that forced reluctant conservative, you know, establishment Republicans to join the populist wing of the Republican Party. And maybe a former president will wake up to recognizing he should quit talking about Operation Warp Speed and be talking about vaccine mandates. Maybe, you know, he won't be asleep down there in Mar-a-Lago too much longer on this issue. But yeah, it's great. It's thanks to so many people in the court of public opinion pushing back.
I'm absolutely accept that. I mean, it's like you can see the sort of crack in the dike is now. It's not going to start spreading all over. And, you know, before very long, I mean, before long at all, we could see the deluge, actually. I mean, and it'll be fascinating to watch. And Robert, you will surf it. You will surf the wave as it comes pouring across. And it'd be very, 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 very entertaining to watch it all, I have to say. At least I will relish it. But I've to change the metaphor slightly, the tide is definitely turning. I mean, when we were last talking about these things, it did look as if you had an enormous battle ahead of you. It's fascinating to see how quickly and how suddenly things have turned. And well done.
It's great. Let's end this on that positive note. Yeah. How about that? It's not very often that you end these videos anymore on positive notes, but I think...
Oh, I don't know. I think overall we've been fairly positive about the things.
Given the news of the world.
Yes.
Given the news of the world.
And I have to say, I mean, Rittenhouse was a big victory. I mean, you do get. I mean, I will quick. We haven't talked about Aberley, but I mean, I think that was a wrong decision. I mean, I can't understand how you can say that there was an intention to. Murder there, to kill someone. I mean, these people had if they'd wanted to do that, they could have done it well before the person died. So, I mean, I can't understand that particular decision. But I think Rittenhouse was so clear-cut that if it had gone the other way, it would have been, I mean, it would have been disastrous, frankly. And I think that was a big event. And I think this swing with the mandate cases, it's going to be an even bigger thing. It's going to be huge, actually.
Yep. Yeah. Two nice big white pills for a year that needed them.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. Let's get some more. Let's get some more of those white pills. And let's get some more people red-pilled as well. That'll help out. Yeah. All right.
It shows that the law is still there. It's still a defense, despite what people think. I mean, however cynical you are about the law, it still works when it, you know, it still works well enough to make a difference and to make a fundamental difference, actually. So, you know, this is an optimist. This is a good moment.
It also shows that if the tide is going to turn and going to change around the world, it's going to come from the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of that, I've never had any doubt, to be honest.
Yeah. It's just a fact. It's going to come from everything that we're going through. Yeah. If there's going to be a change, it's going to happen from the States.
Well, the United States has the most sophisticated legal culture in the world. If it doesn't come, and it's got the Constitution. If it doesn't happen there, well, then God help us. But, you know, I say that I have confidence in the Constitution and in the legal system of the United States. So there we go.
Robert, any final words as we close off this video?
No, I mean, Rittenhouse approved that self-defense and the Second Amendment and constitutional liberty is still alive, even for a poor kid against a politicized process by corrupt prosecutors and corrupt press. And the vaccine mandate cases are proving that if ordinary people fight back, they can actually achieve success even against the president of the United States, the most powerful position in the world, however incompetent or competent he may or may not be. And both are attributable thanks to ordinary everyday people making a difference in the court of public opinion. If they had not done so, neither occurs. It's those judges, it's those individuals, it's even those juries hearing different dissident information from the institutional narrative that allowed justice to occur in either one of those cases. So in the end, it's thanks to ordinary everyday people being involved in the court of public opinion because they make a bigger difference than often they recognize, even if they're just one voice.
And that, by the way, is something else which is, one must say, about the United States, that people have that self-confidence there to come forward and to fight back and push back and take on the federal government. You don't find that in many countries. In the United States, you do.
Yes, well said. All right, Alexander Mercuris in London, thank you very much. And Mr. Robert Barnes, thank you very much. Once again, where can people find you?
At vivabarneslaw.locals.com. That's where there's awesome. Free content, free information all year long.
And we will have that link underneath this video. Please, please connect to Robert Barnes and connect to his channel on Locals. Please go there. Take care, everybody.